This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is CoronaCast, a podcast all about the coronavirus. I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan. It's Wednesday, the 23rd of September.
And Norman, things are looking pretty good in Australia now. We're seeing those case numbers continuing to drop. Victoria is really the only place that's got significant case numbers now, and even there, they're much, much lower than they were before. And we're starting to see places tentatively talking about opening up those internal borders again.
Yes, and that's good news. So South Australia to New South Wales later on in the week, if there's no more community transmission. Queensland's opening up to a series of local government areas in northern New South Wales because there's been no transmission there. So common sense is starting to enter into it. And I think the ACT's been open to South Australia for a little while. The Batuta Advocate had a Cessna 152 landing in Adelaide, which is the high volume air traffic that's going to be expected from ACT to South Australia. But seriously, it's all in the correct direction. So it's really good news.
And only, I mean, Victoria is really hitting its targets in terms of the case numbers coming down there, right on track.
Yes, I mean, a little bit of a blip yesterday, but that seems to be a regular phenomenon. Tuesday, Wednesday spike, perhaps because people aren't getting tested at the weekend. You know, I assume that it's going to return to its downward track, later on in the week.
So Paul's asking about this, actually. Are there any assumptions in Victoria as to the number of cases that aren't being picked up?
That's the worry, because testing numbers have been dropping. And the question is, are the numbers low because people aren't being tested, or are they low because they're low? We talked on CoronaCast a little while ago about an antibody study that was done out of the Australian National University on people undergoing elective surgery. And according to those estimates, on the basis of the first wave, the numbers were 7 times higher than were actually being recorded by testing. We're still waiting on results of a study done at the Kirby Institute. I think informally they think the numbers, the proportion not discovered by the routine testing is going to be lower than 7 times, maybe 2 to 4 times, but we still got to see the results of that test. There will be more cases out there in Victoria than are being detected. The question is whether it matters if you've got community spread down to very low levels.
And I guess then once Victoria opens up and the internal borders just sort of come down again, are we just, Australia is a bubble that is just, we're doing our best and hoping it doesn't continue to come back in from the rest of the world?
So the idea is that we open up as a nation, and that's the big island, and that's the series of little islands, including one medium-sized island, which is Tasmania. So essentially within our borders, we open up. The external borders are another matter, and it's, I think the first priority is bringing Australians back home. The next priority would bring overseas students back into the country, and we could probably do that with some judicious rapid testing and some innovation around quarantine. But at the moment, let's just get our internal borders sorted out.
Yeah, maybe a cause for cautious excitement.
Yes, I think we're going in the right direction. So, Tegan, you've been hearing about some research at the Florey Institute in Melbourne.
That's right. So there's a big research paper that they've brought out today looking at the increased risk of Parkinson's disease from the COVID pandemic, which you might not necessarily see the link straight away. Parkinson's is a neurodegenerative disease, and COVID is not just a respiratory disease, but we think about it as that. But some of the really benign symptoms that we see with COVID indicate that it really could increase the risk of Parkinson's dramatically. And one of those is loss of smell, which we've talked about before. And basically, when you've got loss of smell, the way it occurs in COVID is that it's affecting the neurons. It's sort of, there's some inflammation happening there that's affecting or damaging those neurons in some way, which is a real red flag for Parkinson's disease.
And just to explain here, the tissue in your nose that smells is actually an outcrop of the brain. So there's an outcrop of the brain in your nose, and therefore if the virus comes in, it's getting into your brain via the nose, via this outcrop which is the smelling tissue, the olfactory tissue.
Absolutely. And so what we did see after the 1918 flu pandemic was a big rise in the number of people with Parkinson's disease and other really unpleasant and quite scary syndromes that have to do with brain tissue damage.
Encephalitis lethargica, if I remember rightly from my medical school days.
Exactly, which is an incredibly fascinating and terrifying medical sidebar where people basically had a sleeping sickness that was almost like locked-in syndrome.
But we haven't seen that yet with COVID. They're not talking about encephalitis lethargica, are they?
Well, they actually are. Like, it's not the main thing that they're talking about. They're talking about Parkinson's disease as a big risk, but something like encephalitis lethargica is one of the things that they're warning could be linked to COVID. When we're seeing just the massive scale of this pandemic, the number of people infected, the high prevalence of smell loss as a symptom, they're saying that within the next few years, we're going to start to see some of this neurodegenerative disease coming through. And so what they want is national screening program that would allow for early detection of Parkinson's disease, because at the moment, the main way of diagnosing it is this disordered movement. But usually by the time people have that, they've got the 50 to 70% cell death in the cells that are really important. And so it's quite an advanced disease by then and much, much harder to treat. And really with Parkinson's, we treat the symptoms. We can't really treat the disease itself. So they want to be using the National Bowel Screening Program as a model for a national Parkinson's screening program so that we can jump on this and be ready for it if and when it starts to emerge.
I must say, it does sound a bit self-serving here. I mean, and it's certainly scary for people with problems of smell. So are they panicking people who, there's lots of people listening to CoronaCast who've lost a sense of smell in the COVID pandemic. Are they going to be worried about Parkinson's disease? I mean, that's the first question. The second question is, why would you screen if there's nothing you can do about it?
Well, there is stuff that you can do about it if you catch it early. I think it's about early detection and intervention then, and also just knowing the scale of it. So yeah, I take your point about self-serving, and also, I mean, people have enough to worry about at the moment, don't they? But also, I think one of the points that they made was that the 1918 flu pandemic caught people off guard, and the Parkinson's wave that followed it caught people off guard. And so we need to be looking forward and prepared for it if it happens again.
Interesting.
So Norman, some feedback for you from what we were talking about yesterday was vaccines and the cold chain required to distribute some of the vaccines that are in the pipeline around the world. And you said that most of the ones that are sort of at the front runners have to be kept very, very cold, but a couple of people are querying you on that.
Yes, they're saying that, is it true for the Astra vaccine that it needs to be kept at that temperature? So where I got that from was discussions with CSL in researching this story a few weeks ago, and indeed with an infectious disease expert in Tasmania who's actually worked with a previous version of the Oxford vaccine in Africa. And those versions, according to the two sources I had, did actually have to be stored at quite low temperatures, and that's where I got it from. It does appear that, as always, our coronacasters are right, that Astra is saying that the new version of the vaccine does not have to be stored at that sort of deep temperature. And in fact, they're saying that their vaccine has got an advantage over their competitors because it doesn't. So I stand corrected on that. But that's just explaining where I got that previous information from.
But that's a great outcome, because we were talking about that as one of the potential barriers for this vaccine, but it seems that that's no longer an issue.
It doesn't seem to be, although they're not being utterly specific about the temperature at which it's controlled, but at which it should be stored. But it sounds as if it doesn't need that deep freeze.
And so, Norman, a question from Mark. He's asking about second waves and immunity. So with all the second waves cropping up globally, are we getting more information on how people who had COVID in the first wave, whether or not they're immune to infection the second time around?
So that's a really good question. There still only have been a relatively few reports on people being reinfected. There was the Hong Kong one, which we spoke about a few weeks ago. There's some in America, but there's not been an epidemic of second infections reported. But I think Mark's got a good point there, is that the second wave should show up whether or not we're getting significant reinfections. Now, it's not coming through in the medical literature. Doesn't mean to say they're not happening, but it's looking likely that it's not a massive problem.
And a question from Julie. She's had a cough, sore throat, fatigue and breathlessness, had the COVID-19 test, which was negative, and her GP sent her for an X-ray and did a blood test, both of which showed she had no virus, but she still has breathlessness. It's not normal for her. Would the COVID-19 test have showed if she had had the disease, or is there a different test for that?
Julie, I can't give you personal medical advice, and I'm not sure I trust my medical advice since I did pediatrics a long time since I practiced. But I think that it is possible that there was a false negative on the COVID test, that you had COVID-19, but it didn't show up. It depends how many tests you've actually had. So the COVID test does, COVID-19 test does not necessarily show up if you've got the disease. I mean, certainly if you cough, sore throat, fatigue and breathlessness, I mean, those are cardinal symptoms of COVID-19, but they're also symptoms of other viruses as well. I think if you still have breathlessness, which is not normal for you, you do need to be checked out. It could be that you've got another form of what's called atypical pneumonia or some other problem altogether. So you do need to have a proper checkup and not just assume this is COVID-19.
But there are antibody tests as well that can show if someone doesn't have an active infection, but they have had it in the past.
Yes, but it takes a while for it to show up. And the man in Hong Kong who had a reinfection, he did not show antibodies after the first infection. It was only after the second infection that he showed up with antibodies. So antibodies are a bit fickle and don't necessarily show up, at least early on. So not knowing too much about Julie's story, you just can't rely too much on the antibodies.
Well, that's all we've got time for on CoronaCast today.
And if you'd like to ask a question, because we love your questions, that's what fuel our discussion, go to abc.net.au/coronacast and mention CoronaCast in your question.
And if you want to correct Norman on any other points of fact, please leave us a comment as well and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you can, because we just love reading them.
And without any shadow of doubt or error, we'll see you tomorrow.
See you then.